Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
You're listening to the New Books Network, and this is the Drugs Addiction Recovery Podcast. My name is Lucas Rickard, and welcome, everyone. We're discussing psychedelics today. Let me introduce you to Matthew Oram. Dr. Matthew Oram is a trained historian who has awarded his PhD from the University of Sydney, although he's joining us from New Zealand this afternoon, where it happens to be tomorrow morning, actually. More recently, Matt was an Associated Medical Services postdoctoral fellow at the University of Calgary in Canada. Matt's an expert in the history of psychedelics and drug regulation, and he's here today to talk about his new book called The Trials of Psychedelic Therapy, LSD Psychotherapy in America, which is published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Matt, it's great to have you here. I'm thrilled to talk to you about your book today.
Oh, hi, Luke. Thanks a lot for having me here. I'm looking forward to chatting.
So just to get us started, I suppose, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and more broadly, I suppose, what got you interested in the history of LSD?
Yeah, so as you said, I'm from New Zealand, but was doing my study in Australia. And I'd done most of my undergraduate research, not in anywhere kind of near this field. I'd done my honours thesis on in Holocaust history. But I was looking from where to go from there, and I really needed language skills if I wanted to continue down the kind of German history path. But I've been doing some casual reading around psychedelics, the drugs that always kind of interested me in the power that they have and the perceptual changes that they could produce. And I'd always been kind of fascinated by these mysterious drugs. And I started reading a little bit about, that just talked about the medical research with them, which had been done in the 1950s and 60s, and the kind of amazing results that a lot of these researchers brought up, and the apparent safety of the drug, that kind of when used under in a medical context, the drug was not addictive, LSD was considered kind of completely non-toxic, and that it was really considered kind of by many researchers to be a really promising, safe and effective treatment. But then I was also looking at the way that the drug was regulated and under the Controlled Substances Act of 1970, which is still the regulatory framework for illicit drugs, for controlled drugs. It was listed under Schedule 1, which is the most restrictive schedule, which includes other drugs like heroin and also cannabis. And the criteria for that schedule were that the drug has a high potential for abuse, that it has no accepted medical use in the United States, and that there's a lack of accepted safety under medical conditions. And this seemed to contrast really significantly with what I was reading in the medical literature. And so that was kind of my entry point, was that I was looking at, well, how did it come to be regulated in this way? And a lot of other researchers and commentators also kind of look at the Schedule 1 and see there's other drugs other than heroin, LSD, and marijuana in Schedule 1, but these are three very different, very distinct kind of drugs that can cause a lot of confusion, kind of, you know, from ones that are clearly very dangerous, like heroin, to cannabis, which, you know, considered by many people to be kind of a softer drug, as they're described, And to drugs like LSD, which are undoubtedly very powerful, but which don't have the same kind of toxic or addictive kind of dangers associated with them. And so from there, I launched into a PhD project. As you said, this was in Australia. And then that really got me fascinated into kind of going back through the way that the drugs were regulated. And so my project, so my book started as my doctoral dissertation, and it really got involved with looking very closely at the regulation of pharmaceuticals in America, and taking it really from that angle. And so that has kind of occupied me for kind of the 10 years up to the publication of this last year.
It's a really timely topic. I mean, you really hit on something that's on the tip of everyone's tongues, whether or not it's articles in the New Yorker or the Atlantic or this new book by Michael Pollan. Psychedelics are generating a lot of conversation these days. And I know we're both trained historians, but I thought we'd start in the present maybe and work backwards a little bit.
And so,
I mean, people have called this moment a psychedelic renaissance, if you will. And so I suppose, can you tell us a little bit about the present and I suppose how your book, which is obviously a work of history, adds to this contemporary story of LSD?
Yeah, so first to say, I was completely unaware that this kind of psychedelic renaissance was beginning when I started this project in 2008, and it was it had been brewing for kind of 10 or 15 years before that, but at that moment it was really starting to just the first reports were starting to get published from new research, But I thought I was doing a really obscure topic that was purely historical, and not a lot had been published either on the history. My first year, A Great History by Erica Dick came out, focusing on the history of psychedelic research in Canada, and there was a bunch of other kind of loose articles, but not a lot on it. But as I continued studying, and particularly when I got near the end of this project, more and more new clinical research started getting published. So these were mostly kind of organized by two groups, one called MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, which began in the mid-80s, and it's really focused on MDMA in the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. MDMA, considered a psychedelic by many, but a bit different from what might be called the classic psychedelics like LSD, psilocybin, which is magic mushrooms, the active ingredient in that, mescaline, the active ingredient in a number of cacti like peyote cactus. Other psychedelics like DMT as well, considered classical psychedelics. And they started to get, their research, a long time spent working with the FDA on getting approval to do these things, on designing trial designs, getting the drugs manufactured. And the research started getting really underway kind of in the mid-2000s, and then actual results starting to come out in multiple trials in the last kind of decade. Another group, which is even more relevant to my research, the Hefter Research Institute, it started again in the kind of late 80s, early 90s, and their first, clinical trials really getting underway in the mid-2000s. That was started by a group led by a pharmacologist, David Nichols from Purdue University, who was a specialist in the pharmacology and the chemistry of psychedelics, and they have sponsored research at Johns Hopkins University, which has been one of the major centers. They focused on psilocybin, so a very similar drug to LSD, but with a slightly shorter period of effect, and studies at Johns Hopkins University, led by Roland Griffiths and William Richards, and at New York University, and a number of other studies. And those studies have really followed on almost exactly from the studies in the 60s and 70s.
In fact,
William Richards, who co-founded the Johns Hopkins studies, he was involved in the main research team that I write about. He joined that in 1967 and was there from 90 to 1976. So a lot of the current researchers have kind of talk about this big break between the eras, but there's actually, and I write about this in my book, there's a real direct line between them. Some of the same people were involved, the same research was dropped in the 70s and picked straight back up, or sometimes replicated in more recent decades. But research has been progressing, and more studies have been done, a lot of them focusing, a lot of the psilocybin studies, on treating anxiety and distress associated with cancer diagnosis, also on addiction, so on alcohol dependence, which was a major research focus in the 50s and 60s, on smoking cessation. There's new studies coming out in Britain as well. There's another a research group there called the Beckley Foundation, which is sponsoring research into depression. So there's an enormous amount of research which has been published in this decade, really, and which is all getting very promising results, and is moving through the FDA process towards getting approval as a new drug, which we'll see if that happens, but it is progressing through the stages that the FDA requires. And so it's a really interesting kind of time to be a historian, because as I said, when I started this, I had no idea that this was going to become a really kind of topical issue. And, you know, as historians, we're sometimes a bit slower kind of writing our work than journalists are and stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
And kind of near the end of it, I'm like, wow, I need to, you know, this history that I'm writing about is unfolding again, and what does this mean? And that's difficult. And as I wrote the book, I put a lot of attention into writing an epilogue at the end, because my story kind of finishes really in kind of 1976, but then an epilogue which takes it through from 1976 through the 1980s as other groups who weren't as successful, a group called the Arenda Institute, tried really hard in the 80s and 90s to get LSD research back up and running, but ultimately weren't unable to. But then these other groups, MAPS, HEFTA, kind of managed to do so. But I think that there is, you know, great significance for studying the history of these drugs for their potential future. And it's an area where often simple explanations have been given for why psychedelics kind of failed to become accepted medicine in the 60s and 70s. And those kind of simple explanations are often, you know, repeated by current researchers, by current commentators and other historians. And those simple explanations give simple lessons of, you know, how to avoid the pitfalls of the past. And in my book, I've tried to nuance that and challenge a lot of the kind of assumptions or a lot of the simple explanations. And I hope that provides kind of more lessons for the future, for pitfalls that may be avoided better and lessons to learn.
Well, cool. Let's get into it. That's really exciting. I mean, you suggest that LSD failed to live up to its promise in the 60s and the 70s of entering, and I suppose, you put it, revolutionizing mainstream psychiatry. That's a fascinating claim, and you have to nuance other researchers and how they've dealt with the relationship between mental medicine and these fantastic new drugs. So, when you say that LSD didn't live up to this promise, can you just unpack this a bit for listeners?
Yeah, so LSD emerged on the scene kind of at the start of the 1950s. So it arrived in, it was first discovered in the chemical by Albert Hofmann in Switzerland in 1938. In 1943, he accidentally first ingested the substance. It took a kind of a slow process to get to widespread research. 1947, I believe, the first study was published in Switzerland. Albert Hofmann worked for Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, a major pharmaceutical company in Switzerland, and the drug arrived in the United States in 1949, and research really got underway in the 1950s. And the 1950s was a really crucial kind of era for the history of psychiatry and the history of drug treatment in psychiatry, of psychopharmacology. This was the era when the first what we call antipsychotic drugs were discovered, Thorazine, Rizapine, drugs they were called tranquilizers or neuroleptics at the time, we call them antipsychotics now. So the first effective drugs for treating schizophrenia and psychosis. The first kind of major antidepressants of what's called the tricyclic class or the MAOI class. The first what we now call anxiolytics or anti-anxiety drugs like Miltown or Valium, diazepam. And so this was kind of when we now have more modern drugs than some of these, but this is the period which really kind of created the framework for modern drug treatment in psychiatry. So the major drug classes of antipsychotics, antidepressants, anti-anxiety drugs kind of had their roots in the 1950s. And this was the same time that LSD came on the scene. And it seemed at the time that this was, you know, alongside these drugs, that this was going to be, you know, a critical kind of revolutionary treatment in psychiatry. And it fascinated psychiatrists from all different kinds of backgrounds. So there were some initially who called the drug a psychotomimetic or a madness-mimicking drug, and they thought it produced an artificial psychosis. And there was a lot of debate whether mental illness was based in biology in the brain or whether it was based in psychology in the mind.
Sure.
And this, if LSD could produce a psychosis, then this suggested that psychosis was indeed kind of a neurochemical basis. And Thorazine, the first antipsychotic, blocked the effects of LSD. So some thought that you could create and cure schizophrenia in an afternoon, kind of in the laboratory, and that this would unlock the keys of psychosis, which didn't quite happen, unfortunately. Others of a psychoanalytic persuasion thought that LSD kind of loosened up the unconscious mind, and they called it a psycholytic, and they used it in their psychoanalytic practice to break through patients' offences, kind of unleash their unconscious mind, and to basically quicken and deepen the process of their traditional psychoanalytic procedures. Other psychiatrists, starting with in Canada and Saskatchewan, with research teams led by psychiatrists Humphrey Osmond and Abraham Hoffer, and also researchers in British Columbia, led by Al Hubbard and Ross McLean, developed this procedure where they called psychedelic therapy, where they used a very large dose. Psycholytic therapists had used a smaller dose,
okay,
in many sessions, but psychedelic therapy used one very large dose, but in the context of brief but intensive psychotherapy and in a very supportive setting, to produce a kind of a transcendental mystical experience. And this was particularly for alcoholics, that gave them a whole new perspective on their life, that allowed them to see their patterns of behavior, how it affected the people around them, and to see who they wanted to be and what they wanted out of life. If they were religious, it often had a very religious nature to it, of being at one with God and conversing with God. If they were not religious, it was often an experience of being at one with the universe or at one with humanity. And it often resulted in a greater sense of connection. A lot of the researchers believed that that alcoholism had its roots in alienation, and that this experience brought people closer to their families, to the young ones, that it brought them back into the kind of fold of humanity, even. And mm-hmm. So it was this transformative experience, but only one dose. So it was a very unusual kind of treatment method, but it produced astounding results. And there was consistently reported about a 50% kind of success rate in long-term abstinence in treating what were often the most kind of chronic treatment-resistant hospitalized alcoholic patients. And this, yeah, they were incredible results. And this was, this promised to be a revolution in psychiatry if these kind of results could be maintained. Now, when I say, as you say, that it failed to live up to its promise, in that I'm not necessarily saying that it failed to live up to its clinical process, but that it never entered mainstream psychiatry in that way. That research continued for a period over the 1960s and into the 1970s, but ultimately it was diminishing and it ended, at least for a few decades. And that mainstream psychiatry kind of went in a different direction, away from these kind of treatment forms which blended the use of both drugs and psychotherapy to psychotherapy and drug treatment in psychiatry being quite distinct practices. So the drug, in that sense, I mean, that it failed to become an approved tool of psychiatry to gain FDA approval.
It's really fascinating stuff. But I have to go back to some of your earlier thoughts. When you were talking about some of the arguments that have been put forward about psychedelics in American society and in the regulatory process, you said you tried to nuance some of the existing arguments. So can you tell us a bit more about how you do that in the book?
Yeah, so a very common explanation for the end of psychedelic research and for why LSD never became an approved tool is because of the kind of uproar around the drugs in the mid-1960s. So in the 1950s, there was widespread medical research with the drug. But from the kind of early 1960s, and then particularly in the mid to late 1960s, as many people know, it became a very controversial drug associated with the kind of youth counterculture movement, the hippies. It became kind of the controversial drug, and it was prohibited. So the drug was progressively banned from 1965 from a law called the Drug Abuse Control Amendments of 1965. That's when it was first criminalized broadly. Personal possession was criminalized federally in 1968. In 1970, the Controlled Substances Act was passed and put it in Schedule 1, which is the status that it remains in today. Other states started banning it more strictly in terms of personal possession in around 1966. California, New York were in 1966. And in 1966, there were three congressional hearings which focused on the drug. These were televised. They were hugely kind of controversial. Many people may have heard of Timothy Leary, a Harvard psychologist who started doing psychedelic research in the 1960s. Him and his colleague Richard Alpert were fired from the university in 1963 amid big uproar, and they became the kind of biggest evangelists for the drugs who encouraged the populace to tune in, turn on, and drop out, and really kind of advocated for a revolution in consciousness. Now, there was a huge kind of media and public kind of backlash to the drugs, and as I've said, the drugs were prohibited. And mostly the death of medical research has been blamed on this controversy and on the prohibition of the drug. So intentionally or unintentionally, the government backlash against the non-medical use of LSD killed the medical use of LSD. And this is where I started off in my research, very much believing this. And I was going back and I thought that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which of course regulates the research of the medical use of drugs, was going to kind of be the adversary and that they would be clamping things down. And I was just looking to more closely document this process and to really show, because I was reading a lot of things which said kind of research died at this point and these laws were passed at this point, but they weren't really showing how the law banned the research. And then I started to see that some of the research was actually continuing beyond these points. So I heard a lot of current researchers and even some historians say research ended in 1966 or research ended in 1969 or ended in 1970, or these kind of dates that were very black and white. But doing basic literature reviews of psychedelic research, I was seeing papers coming out in 1969 and 1970 and 1972 and 1976. And so this simply, wasn't quite adding up. And the more I looked into this regulation, the more I couldn't actually see how these laws banned research. They generally all actually had, exclusions for legitimate research and clear paths through which you could get research approved. And research clearly was getting approved. So I looked further and further back and started focusing less on the regulations that prohibited drugs and more on the regulations that controlled pharmaceutical research and development on how you get approval to conduct research with a drug in the United States and how you develop a drug to licensed approval, how you get it on the market. And this focused around so a different framework called the Food, Drugs and Cosmetic Act, originally passed in 1938, and a very significant amendment to that in 1962 called the unimaginably the Drug Amendments of 1962, or sometimes the Kefauver-Harris Amendments. And so in order to get a drug approved to market, you need to submit to the FDA what's called a new drug application or an NDA. Now, prior to 1962, an NDA had to provide proof that the drug was effective when, proof that the drug was safe when used as directed. And there was no regulation very little regulation of pre-market clinical research. So a pharmaceutical house like Sandoz could directly go to a researcher and say, hey, we've got this new drug, LSD. It looks really interesting. You might want to check it out. Here's a sample of it. And then those researchers could immediately go and try it out with some of their patients and write up a report. Now, there's a lot of downsides to this, and this is why it changed, because there's not a lot of ethical control over research. How are researchers, are they ethically giving, conducting their research? You know, what are the patients' rights? A lot of issues there. But it allowed a lot of freedom for some researchers and allowed the research process to be very quick and responsive and allowed researchers to explore a lot of different channels of potential. But in 1962, in response particularly to the thalidomide tragedy, so thalidomide was a sedative which was recommended for treating morning sickness in early pregnancy, but proved to be teratogenic. It caused very significant deformities in children who were born, and many died in utero, and it was a huge tragedy across the world. Now, the drug was never actually approved for use in the United States, but because there was this lax regulation of pre-market use, a lot of people ended up taking it. And so part of the 1962 amendments was the introduction of FDA oversight of pre-market clinical research. So in order to do research with a drug, you now had to approach the FDA and say, this is what I want to do. This is the justifications for doing it. This is how we're going to do it. And this is how it's going to work towards an approved new drug application. Mm-hmm. So it directed research towards being less exploratory and more towards conducting research to meet the demands of a new drug application to produce a commercial product that will be approved by the FDA in treating an illness. It also then introduced the requirement to provide proof of drug effectiveness as well as safety in order to get the drug approved to market. So introducing FDA oversight of research and then providing proof of drug effectiveness for approval were the two kind of key features of this law. And this law had nothing to do with LSD, but it had enormous kind of impact on LSD research after it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and
asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And chapter 4 for me was one of the more interesting chapters. I mean, you've already said that you're nuancing the existing literature because the research doesn't stop. The research just fundamentally doesn't stop when historians said they did, or when historians suggested that it had. And so in chapter 4, which you call Against the Tide, you, I guess, do a deep dive into the Spring Grove State Hospital. And you unpack some of this important research that happens after 1970. So, I mean, can you just shed some light on some of the sort of interesting characters and some of the experiments that were going on?
Yeah, so the research program at Spring Grove State Hospital started in 1963 and went through uninterrupted until 1976, and was really, I think, the largest, the most sophisticated, and the most successful psychedelic research program ever undertaken in this period, definitely, and probably still. And it attracted a lot of the best kind of talent, a lot of researchers who had done work in other locations to it. And it conducted a number of very sophisticated clinical trials. And so I call it Against the Tide because it started in this year, 1963, when the drug amendments of 1962 came into effect. And what those amendments did in shaping research and requiring what was called an IND, which was what you had to submit to the FDA in order to conduct clinical research with the drug, that restricted the number of researchers who were doing it. Not intentionally, but it kind of organized, it formalized the process of getting approval, and it required kind of approval under a research sponsor, which was usually the pharmaceutical company. So on the surface, it appeared like fewer researchers were doing research after 1963, but it actually meant that a lot of the research programs, instead of kind of individual researchers all kind of following their own curiosity, research was organized more into larger scale clinical trials, but a fewer number of them, but more significant trials, which actually had the potential of meeting FDA demands and providing proof of safety and effectiveness that could be used to have the drug approved. 1963 was also the year that Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert were fired from Harvard and the LSD first became kind of controversial. So a lot of people have kind of seen this as the beginning of the end of LSD research, is when on the surface, fewer studies research seemed to be restricting and the drug started to become quite controversial. But this is the year that this project was launched. And it just grew and grew and grew over the 1960s. And so it was founded by a psychiatrist named Albert Kurland and a psychologist named Sam Fudunga. And Kurland was the director of research at Spring Grove State Hospital. And he'd been very involved in psychiatric research for over the 1950s and was involved in some of the early studies with some of the early antipsychotic drugs, and he was a well-respected figure in psychiatric research. And they had a huge number of alcoholics on their wards, and he had a problem, and he was trying to research new ways to treat these patients. And he'd been reading with a lot of interest some of the results that were coming out of Canada saying that LSD could be a therapeutic. Sam Fudunga at the time was a fairly young psychologist, Cornell educated psychologist at the National Institute of Mental Health. And he had also been reading a lot about the therapeutic potential of psychedelics. And he had done a really big literature review, which looked at all of the studies which had then been published. And he saw that there was a lot of potential there, but there needed to be more clearly coordinated studies, more sophisticated controlled studies. And he decided to leave the NIMH in order to and join up with Albert Kurland in order to try and really figure out, do some sophisticated studies in order to determine the effectiveness of these drugs. And so over this period, and this is what you get a lot of as well, is people looking back on the history of the period of this of LSD psychotherapy and the question of whether or not it was effective, because the question of whether or not it was effective is the question which looms over this whole period and the question which still looms today. You know, is it effective or not? And people looking back on the research from today generally fall into two camps. If they're kind of critics of psychedelics, they say, well, most of the research that was done in the 1950s and 60s was anecdotal. It was not scientifically sophisticated. There were no control groups. They were really kind of enthusiastic researchers. And later studies kind of disproved them, and you can't really read much into the studies that were, those initial studies that reported great results. Or they are a camp which says, well, the initial studies were really promising, but research was kind of cut off prematurely by the prohibition of the drug. So it never reached that kind of scientific maturity. Now, after the drug amendments of 1962, clinical trials, in order to provide proof of effectiveness, had to be randomized, controlled clinical trials, usually double-blind studies, which compared the effectiveness of the drug against a control group who were usually given a placebo treatment. And so this was to minimize bias in evaluating the effectiveness of the treatment. And this is what Kurland and Sanford Unger really wanted to do, was to put LSD to the controlled trial test and really to settle the question of its effectiveness. And so they first launched a controlled trial of psychedelic therapy, the same method that had been developed in Canada by Humphrey Osmond and Abraham Hoffer and others. And they launched a controlled trial of alcoholism first. They then collected some other researchers along the way. So one of the most significant ones to join them first was Charles Savage. And Savage's name is not very well known. I don't think it hadn't been written about before, but he's actually one of the most significant LSD researchers, I think, in the drug's history. He first started researching psychedelics in 1949 and had a pretty much uninterrupted career with the drugs until the early 70s. So he had kind of an almost a 25-year career researching psychedelics. He started off researching them in the Naval Medical Research Branch, and then moved to the National Institute of Mental Health. He was then involved with a group called the International Foundation for Advanced Study in California, which kind of some other well-known names like Myron Stolaroff and Jim Fadiman, who is still a very well-known and vocal psychedelic researcher and writer and advocate. They did some really valuable research in the late 50s and early 60s in California. And they, them and another group in California were those who really brought the psychedelic therapy treatment form down from Canada into the United States. And then they kind of brought it over and moved over to Maryland. Later in the decade, Walter Pankey joined. Was a psychiatrist, Harvard-educated psychiatrist, who also did his PhD in religion and did a very famous experiment called the Good Friday Experiment, where he got a bunch of theology students in a special Good Friday mass and gave half of them psilocybin, so that's magic mushrooms, and half of them a placebo in a double-blind fashion and had them describe their experiences, and he had a lot of methods for doing this fairly objectively, and found that you know, that those that were given psilocybin had a deep kind of mystical experience compared to those, and a mystical experience that, which was effectively indistinguishable from those religious mystical experience, spontaneous ones described by kind of history's mystics. And so he joined the team in 1967. So did Stanislav Grof, who was kind of one of a Czechoslovakian psychiatrist who was one of Europe's most experienced and well-known researchers. He's Published a lot of books on his research, and as well is still a quite a well-known name. William Richards as well was a close colleague of Walter Pankey's, who I've said he's kind of the most clear personal link between the past era and the new era. And so these were all highly regarded researchers from fairly kind of orthodox, often Ivy League backgrounds, who had good relationships with federal regulators, with funding bodies like the National Institute of Mental Health, and who were doing, you know, very sophisticated research. And they started off with the study of alcoholics, but they moved into four clinical research areas, which was treating alcoholics, those which with psychoneuroses, the term used at the time, which was a fairly broad term, which kind of encompassed a lot of what we'd now call anxiety disorders and kind of depressive disorders, particularly of the kind of milder forms. Then they anxiety and depression associated with a terminal cancer diagnosis. And so that's one of the treatment indications which has been picked up most significantly in the last couple of decades. That more recent research really just picks up straight where they left off in the 1970s. And then also treating narcotic heroin addicts with the same psychedelic treatment format. And so they had these four kind of main clinical areas, and they were planning or conducted you know, sophisticated controlled clinical trials in all of these research methods, in all of these research areas.
It's a fascinating project, really nuanced too. As you wrap the book up, you title chapter six, "The Quiet Death of Research," really evocative chapter title. So can you tell us about the gradual end of this research phase?
Yeah. So, I mean, the main, the Spring Grove researchers were the largest group, but they were far from the only group still doing sophisticated controlled research in the 1960s. And the most of the research focus and my focus of my book is around the treatment of chronic alcoholism. These were the big claims that were made in the 1950s, that there was a 50% success rate. This was a really major, really important clinical indication. And this was the area which really needed to have some clear, sophisticated research to really settle the question of, is the drug effective in this area? And between the late 60s and the early 70s, there were actually seven controlled trials of LSD in the treatment of chronic alcoholism, which wrapped up in the United States. And these were mostly conducted out of state hospitals and Veterans Administration hospitals. And so effectively, this question of, is it effective, should have been wrapped up in this period between kind of 1969 and 1971, when all of these drugs when all of these trials concluded. But there was a lot of complexity in these trials, and the way that pharmaceutical research and development was kind of moving, the methodology for research around these randomized double-blind controlled trials meant that researchers really focused on, well, if we want FDA approval, or if we want to settle the question of the drug efficacy, we have to have these really rigorous studies. Now, it's really actually very difficult to study LSD therapy under these conditions. As you can imagine, if you give one group of patients LSD and one group of patients a placebo, like a sugar pill, it's very obvious within half an hour or so who got LSD and who got the placebo. It's also more complicated, and that these kind of studies are meant to kind of separate what is the kind of true effects of the drugs, what are the effective drugs, effects of the drugs, from the kind of placebo effect, which can be, you know, the hope and the expectation and the doctor-patient relationship and a lot of what are called kind of non-specific factors around the drug. But LSD psychotherapy and psychedelic therapy was never a simple drug treatment. It was a drug treatment enmeshed in a framework of psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. So the Spring Grove researchers, who most, you know, carefully designed their treatment method and maintained the treatment methods, which had been initially developed in Canada, they would go through about 20 hours of psychotherapy with the patient before they ever received the drug. Then they would have a 10 to 12 hour session with the patient while they're under the influence of the drug, which was done in a very comfortable kind of room that was made up with art and a comfortable sofa. And they would spend a lot of the time reclining with eye shades on, listening to a carefully curated collection of music, soundtrack of music. And they would be accompanied by two therapists for the entirety of it. And the job of these people and all of this kind of set, what they call set and setting, was to help to direct the experience to produce this kind of transcendental mystical reaction that we talked about, which allowed people to kind of reassess their experiences in their lives. But it was really, LSD doesn't just produce this experience by itself. The context, the psychotherapy, the way that the drug is delivered is really critical, is what a lot of the researchers believed, to the success and to the outcome of treatment. But when a lot of researchers focused on, okay, well, what we need is these kind of objective randomized controlled trials, is that they focused on how they designed the blinding in their trials, how they designed the kind of these technical elements of it, but they completely ignored the actual kind of therapeutic context that they were doing. And a lot of them just administered the drug without any psychotherapy or with very minimal psychotherapy and without the kind of supportive directance and guidance that the therapist gave in the original studies. And most of these studies, and unsurprisingly, produced negative results. And that wasn't a surprise to the people who had been doing the studies since the 50s who had developed these treatment methods, because they were studying a completely different treatment. You know, it was just giving LSD to a patient and then seeing what happened was a completely different treatment to giving it in the context of all the psychotherapy and supportive guidance and the whole framework that was designed, which created this treatment called psychedelic therapy. But that wasn't necessarily seen and appreciated by the wider psychiatric community and by the regulatory community. So what happened was that in the early 1970s, you had basically six trials that on the surfaces of them appeared to be fairly sophisticated controlled trials, which showed that LSD was not effective. And then you had the one study from Spring Grove, which had some positive results, but they were slightly underwhelming results. And the reason for that was because it was so difficult to design a control condition which could allow you to do a control trial, but still allow you to use the methods that they had. So what they did is that they compared a low dose to a high dose of LSD with the same therapeutic framework. And what they thought was that you needed a high dose of LSD to produce the mystical reaction, the transcendental experience, which would have lasting effects on alcoholics, and that the low dose would mean that there was no question that the patient got LSD, but that it shouldn't produce the same results. And what they found was that they were getting around the 50% success rate that they were expecting with the high dose, but actually that the low dose was more effective than they realized. And so that kind of made the treatment appear less effective when you're talking about the statistical significance of it. Because when you're looking at these studies, they're not actually looking whether the study is reporting good results or not. It's not how many people improved or the percentage of people improved, but whether there is a statistically significant difference between the experimental group and the control group. And that narrowed that difference between the control group. And the control group was still getting something like 35% treatment success, which compared to about 12% treatment success for their standard kind of hospital procedure, which didn't involve LSD. But on the surface, these results appeared kind of underwhelming. And so to a lot of people in the medical establishment, these results that came out in the 1970s basically seemed to answer the question, and the answer was, well, the drug hasn't lived up to its promise, the drug isn't effective. But, and I go into a lot of detail into the book, into looking into these studies and into the design of them and the design of the treatments that they delivered and how this likely influenced the results that they were actually getting out of them. So I believe that the results of these trials are quite misleading because they weren't actually testing the hypothesis that was kind of delivered by the original research, that a specific treatment form would be effective in alcoholics. But that still didn't completely end it. So research was still not banned. In 1975, the FDA still listed five research programs which were approved to use LSD in human trials. Whether or not they were doing that is a more difficult question, and it seems like about four out of five of them weren't actually doing active research. But the Spring Grove research team continued through the 1970s. The major difficulty was getting funding, because the National Institute of Mental Health kind of stopped funding projects because the results of studies had not been promising. But they managed to scrape together funding and continue their research. But research was very much dying out. The eventual death in 1976 at Spring Grove was actually then a result of a very mundane HR spat, in which Albert Kurland, he was by then in a the superintendent of a research unit called the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, which was attached to the Spring Grove State Hospital, and he, as well as being the director of research for Spring Grove State Hospital, was the director of research for the Maryland State Department of Mental Hygiene. And he had basically built this research center, and it was it's still a very significant research center. And he had built it and designed it, you know, specifically to do more psychedelic research, but also other more broader psychiatric research. And a few of the researchers who weren't involved in the psychedelic research got into a spat with Kurland, who was maybe a bit of a kind of a traditional authoritarian superintendent who didn't like being questioned in the press, and he fired these people when they sued him, and it went through the Maryland legislature, and there was a lot of debate around it. But strangely, and I followed this controversy very closely in the Baltimore Sun as it unfolded, and there was, you know, a couple of dozen or more articles about it over the 1970s. The debate stretched over years. And it barely mentioned psychedelics, even though this was a lot of the work that they were doing. But it was a debate around how funds were being administered and maintained, and how employers were being treated in certain ways. And in the end, it resulted in Albert Kurland being removed as the head of the Maryland Psychiatric Research Center, and the administration of that center being transferred from the State Department of Mental Hygiene to the University of Maryland. And in that, the whole organization was reorganized, and most of the psychedelic researchers left, and the psychedelic research program was ended. And so it really existed because it continued through the 1970s because Albert Kurland was a powerful and determined research administrator in the state of Maryland who was able to sustain it. And when he was gone, it kind of disappeared.
Matt's new book is called The Trials of Psychedelic Therapy, LSD Psychotherapy in America. It's obvious that it contributes to vitally important current events and important debates. It's not only topical, but it's also thought-provoking. Matt, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you very much, Luke. It was great to talk to you.